Tipping points of convergence. From the studies of respected think tanks, like the World Watch Institute, founded in 1974 to independently research critical global issues, and the World Resources Institute, founded in 1982 to analyze environmental policy, to UNESCO's Millennium Ecosystem Assessment Synthesis Report, drafted by 1,300 scientists in 95 countries, it's clear that the best minds of our time have gone beyond the warnings of the past to alert us to dangerous trends of unsustainability. We're now living the time that they warned us of in the past, and the magnitude of the changes we're experiencing is our cue to wake up and take notice. In 2005, the journal Scientific American published a special edition titled Crossroads for Planet Earth, which confirmed the uniqueness of our time. One section describes the human race as, quote, now entering a unique period in history, end of quote. The purpose of the issue was to identify a number of global crises that, if left unchecked, hold the potential to end life and civilization as we know it today. Everything from new diseases with no known cures and energy-intensive nations exhausting Earth's finite resources to never-before-seen levels of global poverty and habitual disregard for the health of oceans, rivers, and rainforests. The conclusion of the journal was unanimous. We simply cannot continue living as we have in the past if we expect to survive even another 100 years. Our planet cannot sustain our habits. Over 1,000 scientists from various disciplines have honed this idea into a report released by the World Economic Forum, aptly titled Global Risks 2013. The bottom line is that the conditions of climate change and the teetering of global economy pose the possibility of what they call a perfect storm of crises that will impact the world for a long time to come. The point that these organizations and others are bringing into public awareness is that each of the scenarios identified in their reports is catastrophic, and all are happening right now. The contributors to these special bulletins and reports are certainly not alone in their assessments of our situation. They, along with other science-based researchers, who range from independent scientists and authors to members of the intelligence communities of the United States, including the Pentagon and the CIA, which see the crises as threats to stability and security, have all sounded unmistakable alarms loudly and clearly. The alarms are telling us that we're already in trouble. Nature is already at the tipping point of losing the oceans, forests, and animals that make life as we've known it possible. When we factor in the reality of broken economies, vanishing resources, climate change, and the loss of entire industries, along with the jobs they provided for our families and communities, then the individual extremes take on new meaning. The tipping points of no return in different areas of our lives are leading us not only to our time of extremes, but to a time of convergence as well. While different reasons have been given as to why so many extremes are occurring in such a brief period of time, there seems to be a general consensus regarding the big picture. Something extraordinary is unfolding in our world. So how do we begin to define something so big that it's been anticipated by native peoples for thousands of years, has the potential to alter every life on Earth, yet cannot be encapsulated in a single word or an idea? It may be precisely because the implications of our time of extremes are so vast that there's been a reluctance to even acknowledge that we're in the midst of something so big. Maybe the conditions, challenges, and crises we face, along with our communities, our nations, and our world, are best summed up by evolutionary biologist E.O. Wilson. He states that we're living what he calls a bottleneck in time, when the stress upon both our resources and our ability to solve the problems of our day will be pushed to their limits. Having discovered that diverse and respected organizations are all pointing to the same critical issues and reaching the same general conclusions, it's clear that we're in the middle of a rare transition for our world. The question is, where does the transition lead? Are we headed for a world of destruction, or are we headed for a world of transformation? Our failure to recognize the big picture and where the trends are leading us may ultimately be the worst problem we face. Fortunately for us, this problem is solvable. Us and them versus we. When we look closely at the biggest shifts in our world, we see a common theme that brings the reason for so much change front and center and into crystal clear focus. It's simply this. The only things that are collapsing are ways of thinking and ways of living that are no longer sustainable. The fact that so many facets of daily life are breaking down so quickly tells us where the thinking of the past no longer works. And from peak debt to peak oil, the simultaneous buckling of big systems tells us that now is the time to rethink the very beliefs that have driven our choices in the past. It's facts such as these that have led many experts to view our time of extremes as a time of crisis as well. But the word crisis doesn't necessarily mean that something bad is happening. It can also mean that something big is happening. I used to have an aversion to the word crisis. In recent times, however, I've come to appreciate the word for one reason. If we say we're in crisis, it means that we still have time to fix the problem. If we say that the crisis is over, it implies there's nothing more we can do. So the fact that we're still in the midst of the crises of climate change, economic volatility, and energy production means that we have a chance to adapt. These are consequences that we face today for a way of thinking from the past. Because the world has changed, these issues are asking for our immediate attention. Never have so many people been asked to think so differently and to solve so many big problems in such a short period of time. We live in a world where everything is connected. We can no longer think in terms of us and them when it comes to the consequences of the way we live. Today, it's all about we. It was precisely to create a greater sense of we-ness that we developed the internet, for example, that links us together. The transportation industry that moves people between continents and nations. Our financial markets that operate 24/7 and the cell phone networks that allow us to text our loved ones on the other side of the world at 3 a.m. The very purpose is to connect us, but the connection has become like a double-edged sword. Our global connections allow us to share everything from our music, art, culture, and celebrations, the good, to the not-so-good problems of energy, food, and money. During a recent trip to Cuzco, for example, the high-elevation ancient capital of Peru nestled in the Andes Mountains, I witnessed the grand opening of a McDonald's restaurant. It was located just a couple of doors down from a 400-year-old Catholic cathedral in the city's central square, which houses some of the oldest relics of the Catholic Church, even predating the Spanish conquest. There's little beef in the area, but the local staple of alpaca meat is plentiful. So the Andean version of the Big Mac is actually made of two patties of alpaca in a sesame seed bun covered by that famous special sauce. I witnessed the same thing happening on the Tibetan plateau in the capital of Lhasa, located at an altitude of 12,000 feet above sea level, where the local meat, yak, is substituted for the beef used in the West. The Tibetans in the area love to joke about the big yak burger that has replaced the traditional Big Mac. The point is that globalization has made McDonald's, Starbucks, KFC, for example, familiar sights in remote places of the world today, just as they've been for decades in the biggest cities of the United States and Europe. The same oneness that makes it possible to share such commercial pieces of culture, as well as fashion, art, and music, also makes it inevitable that big problems in one part of the world will affect the lives of entire communities in other parts of the world. This means that the effects of climate change on crops, for example, are showing up as price increases that reflect the smaller harvest from drought-stricken fields of the world. The slowdown of the global economy is showing up as the closure of factories and the loss of jobs in our local neighborhoods. And the rise in global debt is translating into weakness in our local currency and the record low interest rates that we're being paid on our CDs, IRAs, and retirement savings accounts. Through these simple examples, it's clear that we can no longer separate the world out there from what's happening in our classrooms, in our offices, and on our family dinner table. Our oneness also means that we can no longer separate spirituality from our everyday lives. It's common during the media session and interviews before a public seminar for the interview to ask me if I'm going to talk about the science stuff or the spiritual stuff. My answer to the question is generally not what the interviewer is hoping for. "Where do you draw the line between spirituality and our everyday lives?" I reply. It's an important question, because the artificial separation between science and spirit is precisely what keeps us stuck in the thinking that prevents us from adapting to today's crises. What could be more spiritual, I ask, than applying the deepest truths revealed by the best science of our time as the real-world solutions in our everyday lives?